Okay, so welcome back, everyone. So this week it's a great pleasure to have Chandra Varma as our speaker. So my understanding is that Chandra is a recalled professor at UC Berkeley. And I guess my guess is that he was lured out of retirement by the wealth of experimental data that still requires explaining. But I'm sure he has a better explanation for so I think it's needless to say that he's had a very illustrious career at Bell Labs, UC Riverside. He's made many major contributions to strongly correlated physics, in particular high TC superconductivity. So we're very happy to have him talk about some exciting recent experiments and his take on them.
Thank you very much, Tim. I'm going to talk about some experiments done in Shanghai, which I used to visit at least once a year. These were done in the group of Professor Lei Xu. And I actually, when I first saw the experiments, I thought they were very interesting, and I actually participated a bit in the design of the experiment and the analysis. And I'll talk about them. Then I'll talk about a particular method of trying to understand those results. So let me first say that the experiments that I will talk about are in this preprint in the archive, and this is the title. So I'm going to describe to you these experiments, and I'll tell you why I call them ultra-quantum. And then I will talk a little bit about the theory. So here are the principal actors. This is the lab of Professor Lei Xu at Fudan University, who was in the first course in condensed matter physics that I taught. She was a graduate student. The first course I taught at the University of California, Riverside, and now she's a professor, has done doing wonderful things. And this particular discovery that she made in one compound, I think you'll find quite remarkable. And I'm also going to talk about a bit of theory. Let me make a general remark, if I may. I've been watching experiments on spin liquids that developed in the last 30 years, and almost all of those experiments at low temperature are dominated in an interesting way by properties of defects. So although it's very interesting that these materials do not order, and they do not even, many of them do not even order as spin glasses. However, impurities have very, very dominant effect in their properties, so that what is an intrinsic spin liquid really has not been known. I say here that spin liquids are an example of what happens to a field where theory is done without firm experimental data to serve as a guide and a filter. So in that case, you can do exact solution of unrealistic models, and that's very interesting. It teaches one a lot, like the Kitaev model taught us a lot. Or people go off in their own tangents in making certain approximations in theory, and then when experiments come across some data, they point to some aspect of the theory, and the theorists point out some aspect of the experiment, and they're mutually happy, but nothing is learned. So it's very important to have clear experimental data in physics to serve as a guide and a filter. And the experiment that I will talk about, I believe, revealed the intrinsic behavior of at least one class of spin liquids, and there may be many other classes of spin liquids. And I will show you that the simple experiments done in this compound that I will talk about, from them you can characterize the low energy scale invariant fluctuations and be also able to say that these materials have colossal density of ultra low singlet fluctuations. By ultra low, I mean below about 10 to the minus 3 of the exchange energy. And this is not due to defects or the kind of frustration that you come across in spin ice or any such thing. It's really due to quantum mechanics that some excitations, which are singlets, have moved to very, very low energy, and that's why I use the phrase ultra quantum. And I'll tell you a little bit about some theory whose direction was chosen by what I learned from these experiments. So the compound that I will talk about, and one has to be lucky or very smart to discover such compounds, and that's Professor Lei Shu. And the compound they decided to investigate is a compound that there are three compounds here. Let's look at this last one here. This is completely non-magnetic and it will play a role. This, in this compound, lutetium and antimony lie on Kagome lattices, two-dimensional layers of Kagomes, and zinc and copper lie at the centers of the hexagons in the Kagome. So this is a non-magnetic, compound, the zinc two. In this first compound, the non-magnetic compound, zinc lies both in the lutetium Kagome layer and the antimony Kagome layer. Then there's a compound in which the zinc is completely substituted by copper in both layers, but it's important to realize that the two coppers not merely are in different layers, they're also coordination oxygens is different. One is octahedrally coordinated and one is tetrahedrally coordinated. And then, as a test on our thinking about whether this is a two-dimensional compound, a compound was made in which one layer was hopefully completely zinc and the other layer was hopefully completely copper. And that thing did not completely succeed. There are about 3% intersubstitution of zinc and copper. You see, copper and zinc lie right next to each other in the periodic table. They're chemically similar in many instances. And chemistry is the largest energies. Magnetic energies are order of magnitude smaller. So this will illustrate how defects can completely dominate low energy properties. But to a zeroth approximation, the properties here per copper are similar to that when both layers have only copper. And this is the ultra pure compound that I will talk about, okay? Now, the coppers form, because they are the centers of the hexagons in the Kagome layers, they form triangular lattices. But the lattice is slightly distorted in a monoclinic fashion so that the triangles are not perfect. We do not know the detailed Hamiltonian, but an important question to ask was, is it magnetically two-dimensional? And from the fact that in this zinc copper compound, the distances between the coppers are roughly square root of 2 larger than in this first compound, square root of 3 larger than in this compound. We believe it's two-dimensional, and I'll give you other instance, another reason to think that they are two-dimensional. The distances between the coppers are very large, about 6 angstroms. And when that happens, the next neighbor interaction can also be important. So it's almost certainly not a pure three-dimensional Heisenberg model, but it has no spin orbit scattering and so on. Lutetium is a perfectly, lutetium 3 plus and antimony 5 plus are perfectly inert spherical ions. Okay, so first thing you have to do is to characterize the magnetic susceptibility to get some idea of the exchange and to get some idea of whether there are magnetic impurities. And I'm going to stress this LCSO, and you measure the susceptibility. Here's the inverse susceptibility plotted as a function of temperature. And you discover that if you want to fit it up to 20 Kelvin, you need 2 Weiss constants with equal amplitude. One of them is about 4.5 Kelvin, and the other is about 25 Kelvin. And we believe those reflect the dominant exchange energies in the 2 layers of copper, 2 distinct layers of copper. And you'll see that again and again in other properties. In this LCSO, you can measure the magnetic susceptibility. This is actually AC susceptibility measured at some particular frequency with very low magnetic field. And it's measured from 4 Kelvin to 0.1 Kelvin. Actually, it's measured to 60 millikelvin. And you see that the temperature dependence is exceedingly weak. And if you say that the rise from here to here is due to Curie susceptibility, then you come to that the orphan spins or magnetic spins are less than 10 to the minus 3. But I'll show you from specific heat measurements that at very low temperatures, there are some 1% Schottky impurities, even in this very pure compound, and we do not know the exact source of these 2 levels or Schottky levels, but they are small enough that they will not quantitatively affect the properties that I will speak about. Incidentally, the temperature dependence of this magnetic susceptibility is frequency independent over the 2 orders of magnitude in frequency, so we know that there is nothing spin glassy about this material. There's a tiny little rise here, and that corresponds to about a part in 10 to the 4, and we don't fully understand it. Okay, so the important message is very high purity and 2 different exchange energies corresponding, we think, to 2 different layers. Now comes some of the main part of the data. So let us measure the total specific heat. So this is really the raw specific heat data plotted on a log scale on both axes here. And this is plotted per mole of the compound. And you see that here is the non-magnetic compound in black. And here in the blue full dots is this compound LCSO that I will emphasize, and this one that I can speak about if there are questions. So we know that the difference between here and here is the magnetic specific heat, because it's the same lattice structure, and zinc and copper have essentially the same weight, same atomic weight. So up to about 15 to 20 Kelvin, you can get a magnetic specific heat pretty good. And if there is some component of the magnetic specific heat here, we have to deduce it by some other means. So if you subtract out this, the difference between these two, account for this rise here, which is the Schottky and the nuclear Schottky, you get the specific heat that you are interested in, which I'll call the magnetic specific heat. And this is plotted here as specific heat divided by temperature on a linear scale with a log in temperature here to show data over a wide range. And this is the data, specific heat, magnetic specific heat at zero magnetic field. And you see that at low temperatures, it is a constant. This temperature where it's turning over is about 0.4 or 0.5 Kelvin. There is a logarithmic or a very low power decrease here. There seems to be another contribution, if you take this and extrapolate it, there's another contribution which looks approximately a constant here. And if you were to plot it on a linear scale, you would see that much more clearly. But then there is again a logarithmic decrease or a low power law decrease. If you apply magnetic field, the low temperature specific heat goes down, as you would expect, related to the some Riemann splitting. And it is recovered at high temperature. And if you integrate over all these curves, I'll show you, if you integrate Cm over T over temperature, you get the entropy at any temperature. And I'll show you in a moment. Now, the moment people see this Cm over T constant, they say, oh, there must be some kind of spin-on, some kind of Fermi surface. Now, Cm over T, a constant, does not by itself imply a Fermi surface. You have to do some other experiments to be sure or to rule that out. And we'll rule that out, actually. Now, from the data that I showed you here, and let me just first concentrate on the data in this compound, the integrated value at different magnetic fields as a function of temperature. And what you find is that the entropy at any temperature minus the entropy at the lowest temperature, which is 10th of a Kelvin, you get a curve which is what you expect. This is only up to a little over 20 Kelvin. However, this saturation is happening not at R log 2, but at about 0.36 R log 2. And as you apply magnetic field, it's getting there, but not quite. And that's because we cannot really subtract accurately here. So you can use an alternate way. You can measure the magnetization as a function of temperature at different fields, which is the same as the derivative of entropy with respect to field. And from that, get out the entropy as a function of field, and that's a red curve. So now you see that in this region, there are two different ways of measuring, and they agree to within 1% accuracy. This cannot be deduced more accurately thereafter, this other DMDT method. And then you see that all of these come back to the same point. Okay? So there is the observed entropy is field independent. The total integrated observed entropy is field independent, but whatever you are missing. It is dark. You cannot see it, and it is field independent. It's field independent implies that it is singlet, and the fact that it is independent of magnetic field up to 9 Tesla, 9 Tesla is 9 Kelvin, and you're going across that temperature range, implies that it is not some kind of ordinary singlets which you can turn into you know, you can break a singlet into MS equal to 0 plus minus 1 by a magnetic field. You can't do that. There is some obstruction to its reaction to a magnetic field, and this dark entropy remains dark at least up to 9 Tesla. Let me also say that we can do this experiment by changing its history, applying the field at high temperature, measuring it as a function of temperature, going down, apply the field at high temperature, start measuring from low temperature and go up in temperature. This data remains invariant. So it is not some simple metastability, okay? Next is the question of the muon relaxation rate. So you can measure muon relaxation rate, which is some measure of the integrated magnetic fluctuations spectra at a point in space where the muon resides. Okay? A relaxation rate in muon is some square of the local magnetic, you know, square of the fluctuations of the local magnetic field. This can also be expressed as integral over Q of the imaginary part of chi, Q, and omega. Okay, this is the same thing. Time, and that will then give you some kind of a time at which the characteristic fluctuations are changing. And this is plotted here. And it's again a constant at low temperature. This is a very remarkable thing. This has been observed in many spin glasses, not as cleanly and neatly and as unique temperature dependent. And when we don't understand something, we give it a name. It's called persistent spin fluctuations. Well, persistent spin fluctuations are very interesting. It means that there is some integral of the fluctuation spectra which is sticking around at the lowest temperature. And in this case, it is measured down to 16 millikelvin. And then what you notice is that when it is a constant, if I just adjust this vertical scale of the relaxation rate, the relaxation rate and the specific heat divided by temperature have the same temperature dependence. They begin to fall off at a similar temperature. Okay? So that's one message. Now, if you have a relaxation rate which is constant in temperature at low temperatures, you don't have a Fermi surface. Fermi surfaces will always give you, ordinary Fermi surfaces will always give you a Coringa relaxation rate proportional to temperature, okay? So this is another interesting finding. The third thing is that if you take the CM over T, if you take the CM over T that I showed you and extrapolate this log all the way to zero temperature, you see that it intersects at around 4 Kelvin, which was the Weiss temperature here. And if you take this, it's intersecting at about 20 Kelvin, which was the other Weiss temperature. If you take this and add to it, so if there is an exchange energy of 4 Kelvin, then from high temperature down to of the order of the exchange energy, the specific heat will be dominated by pairwise fluctuations, which you can estimate from the high temperature series expansion. That looks like this. And if you add this part and take out the rest and say there's another constant part and it decays, then you can, within about 10% accuracy, discover that the integrated entropy under this green curve and the integrated entropy under this yellow curve are the same. Okay, so these are the entropy of the two distinct layers. First of all, they are characterized by going towards zero logarithmically at their respective vice temperatures. And secondly, this ratio here is inversely as 4 to 20, meaning inversely as the vice temperature. In other words, what I'm trying to say here is that the whole entropy and the relaxation rate are simply characterized by one parameter per layer, which is related to the exchange energy, which we can estimate to some accuracy by the high temperature departure from QE law, in other words, by the Weiss temperature. Okay, so you have weakly interacting layers. Then another remarkable thing is that if you look at the magnitude of this relaxation rate and say that, hey, this local field fluctuations, root mean square, is like spin half or thereabouts, fluctuating at a distance of 5 or 6 angstrom. You're just measuring, you know, muons don't do any exchange like in NMR. Okay, it's simply dipole magnetic field. You can roughly estimate it and get out this tau, and the tau you come out with, 1/tau, is again of the order of the Weiss temperature. Okay, this is a very approximate thing, but it's significant. Within factors of two, it's giving you the same parameter. Okay? Okay, so let me summarize the experimental results again with a theoretical perspective. Every measure property is characterized, at least semi-quantitatively, by the same one parameter, exchange energy, one per layer. Interesting phenomena starts off at high temperatures as log of theta Weiss over temperature, and then the scale invariance stays. And finally, this requires a tiny bit of calculation to do. If you assume that the absorptive part of the fluctuation is some constant times mu b squared over the Weiss temperature times tangent hyperbolic omega over 2t, you can show that this will give you with a log cutoff, okay? If you say that further there's a log cutoff, it's very easy to calculate from that what the specific heat will look like. It will look like what you observe. It will also give you the relaxation rate with the same Weiss temperature coming in. Except that we have to add, we have to put this parameter C. If it was the full fluctuation spectra of spin halves, C would be expected to be 1, because there's a sum rule on this. But we require C because we have this ultra low energy or ultra quantum singlet fluctuations, the missing entropy, okay, which we cannot recover. I call it dark for a good reason. It's got entropy, but it's a singlet. You cannot think of a spectroscopic experiment to see it. I'm sure if you apply a large enough magnetic field, spins will line up, but 9 Tesla does not do it. The other important point is that this coefficient C, you know, from which I want to get, let's go here to back to this. If I add to this entropy the high temperature series expansion entropy, this is 63%, that adds up to about 7%. So what is missing is about 57%. Now, it turns out that if you put dimers on a triangular lattice, classical dimers on a triangular lattice, You can do it in a number of ways, and there are old calculations from the 60s in which the entropy of dimers on a classical lattice is calculated, and that happens to be about 57%. Okay? The experiments may be off by 3 or 4%. Okay, but the number in the calculation is precise. It's not exactly 57%. It's some crazy number with square roots and square roots of pi's and whatnot, but it's approximately 57%. Okay. Now, of course, we have a quantum mechanical problem. This is not dimers on a triangular lattice, but this will serve to me to give a direction to think. Okay. Let me quickly mention Herbert Smithout. Herbert Smithout has a low temperature contribution, which is a constant, but only if you apply about 10 Tesla in magnetic field to quench the magnetic impurity specific heats which dominate completely at low temperatures. Okay? It may have some unmeasurable entropy, but you do not know about it because there's no non-magnetic analog. Its great virtue is that single crystals are available and inelastic neutron scattering has been done, and it has scale invariant fluctuations. A bit different from what I had to assume, but my guess is that after you remove the impurities on this compound, they will look like hyperbolic tangent omega over T. There's another compound which is a triangular lattice. It has similar properties, but all the entropy is recovered. And again, we do not know. So Herbert Smithout, you know, is a Kagome. This is a triangular lattice. But again, we do not know the exact structure. Okay? Okay, so this is all I'm going to speak about the experiment. Are there any questions on the experiment?
Just to make sure, it's not a single crystal. Are the experiments done on single crystals or?
Oh, I'm sorry, I should have stated that it's not been possible to make a single crystal of this compound. This is a powder sample, okay? There are good reasons for that. I learned lutetium melts at such a high temperature that you cannot co-melt these things without them evaporating. So it's not been possible so far to make a single crystal.
Thank you.
Any other question?
Can I also ask a question? If you are dealing with singlets, are there experimentally any indications what could be energy of singlet triplet transition?
Excuse me, Daniel
singlet,
asked me again.
Singlet triplet transitions, are there any indication of such transitions? What could be a corresponding energy scale?
I still cannot understand your question. Can you write it down and then we'll answer it later? Okay?
Maybe I'll ask later. Okay, fine.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. So I want to understand these properties. And so I want to consider some kind of Heisenberg bottle on a triangular or a Kagome lattice where I do not know the exact Hamiltonian, but I expect it to be Heisenberg with near neighbor and next nearest neighbor interaction. And maybe I should have put this J inside with Jij, some variations, okay? As you know, that the best current belief is that triangular lattices have non-coplanar order, and it's liable to be unstable and probably to very small perturbations. There are lots of numerical calculations giving variety of results. I can comment on them if you like at the end. Kagome lattice is supposed to be a spin liquid. There's some very nice early numerical calculations showing some, up to the 10th, below energy of order, 10th of exchange energy, some kind of ground state entropy with singlets or entropy remaining. And of singlet kind. Then, of course, there were lots of theories formulated in early, what I call desperate days, trying to make RVB come out right, and I can comment on them if you like. Now, I want to make, as I said, these calculations that I'm talking about. Recently, Krishnamurti from Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore has joined me in checking my calculations. So I'm guided by the experiment that there's this large dark entropy. And so I want to start with the basis of dimers, okay? But I don't want to have crazy fourth order, 10th order kinetic energies moving dimers. I want to start with this nearly Heisenberg model, okay? So I'm going to put these dimers on the lattice, and each dimer is centered at a point mu. So here is my triangular lattice, and here is a dimer. It is centered at a point mu, and there are other point mu's. So I'm going to start with this basis, and then I'm going to consider the interaction of this spin with these dimers, or the excitation spectra of these dimers, and this spin with the interaction of this dimer. So I will have this dimer at mu with a left neighbor and a right neighbor, and then I will consider the interaction of left with all these here and the right with all these here. And I'm going to try to solve the prior problem of this dimer interacting with excitations of other dimers. I want to do this problem exactly. And then I'm going to try to make this problem self-consistent. Okay? Now, you see that if you have this dimer, this spin interacts with the excitations of these other dimers, those which from this point look like S wave. And this interacts with all its neighbors, or the fluctuations, something which looks like S wave. So for a dimer, the fluctuations of the rest of the media can be divided into a part which has even parity about this, about the center of the dimer, and the odd parity. And if these are singlet fluctuations, if these are S-wave fluctuations, and S-wave fluctuations making even and odd parity, they are one-dimensional objects. And you see that I'm moving towards a problem that I solved a long time ago, which was the problem of two interacting impurities in a metal. You have two interacting impurities in a metal, and the metal has got these fermions, and the fermions have charge fluctuations and they have spin fluctuations. But if you do the problem in a bosonization fashion or by Wilson renormalization group, all that's important are spin fluctuations. The charge fluctuations are completely irrelevant. Okay? And this problem, as I say, was first discovered. This is Barbara Jones' thesis with me while she was a student at Cornell. And this problem was then solved by analytical methods, conformal field theory, by Affleck and Ludwig, and again looked at by abelian bosonization by Clemasir and Krishnamurti and me, and I'm going to adopt the approach here. So we have these two impurities that are on either side of this dimer interacting with some parameter k, and then S sub L is interacting with everything around, and S sub R is interacting with everything all around. And I can write this as S sub R, L plus S sub R interacting with even objects around S L plus SR and SL minus SR interacting with odd objects. Okay. Plus the kinetic energy of odd and even whatever objects they are, spin fluctuations, which I can bosonize. I'm going to assume there are some spin fluctuations, and I'm going to bosonize them. So for the two, for the pairwise problem, pair problem interacting with fluctuations around, if I call them some fluctuations, kinetic energy of fluctuation, this is an exact representation of the problem. Now, this object in the dimer, I can go into singlet and triplet channel, so of SL plus SR. So this part of the problem is can be absorbed into a renormalization of this parameter K, and we only have to deal with this object. Now, so this is really one odd parity spin fluctuation channel that we have to deal with, and it's a one-dimensional channel in some effective coordinates. And it can be bosonized and turned back into fermions. And this is the essential approach of the conformal field theory that Affleck and Ludwig and later Ludwig and Maldacena also did. I want to do it slightly differently. What we did when we tried to solve this problem is to say, hey, we can turn all these objects into some effective fermions in two channels, right? This has two channels already, right? This has disappeared. And, but I have spins. Now, I want to turn the spins into fermions as well. And we hit upon the trick of making a two-site version of the Jordan-Wigner transformation. So if you say that there are some effective fermions on the left side and some effective fermions on the right side, and say that the Z component is related to their number, and the plus and minus components, if you write them like that, then you will discover that the objects on the right obey the commutation rules of the spin operators. So you have turned this problem into a problem of an eight state problem plus the kinetic energy of the fermions. The eight state problem is that this left fermion or the right fermion here, NL and NR, which is this object, can be either occupied or unoccupied. And you have this C and C dagger of this object left. That I call that those fermions will be called the C fermions, and they can be either there or not there. So this is an eight-state problem characterized by zero or one of NR, NL, and NCO. And what we did was to make a strong coupling expansion, meaning we'll solve this eight-state problem exactly. And then realize, a la Wilson, that these fermions are coupled, these are one-dimensional fermions, the local fermion coupled to the neighbor, and the neighbor coupled to the neighbor, and so on and so forth. And that these successive parts are successively irrelevant. If you introduce a parameter lambda for the renormalization group, then this leading term will be lambda to the half, and the next term will be lambda to the n over 2. So this is a convergent strong coupling expansion. By going this, we have avoided this horrible thing that people were doing of turning into extra degrees of freedom of fermions or spins, and then you have gauge redundancy, you have 2 degrees of freedom change to 4, and all these part-on business, which has led, I believe, to much confusion. So I have this eight-state problem, and this eight-state problem neatly divides itself into two independent four-state problems, one of which has total number of fermions even, and one which has total number of fermions odd. And quite generally, the spectrum of these eight states is degenerate. There's some kind of supersymmetry. That's point one. Next important point is, after you diagonalize this problem and you diagonalize this problem, if you look at the matrix element of the parameter C naught, you discover that for any given initial state here and any final state here, or vice versa, the matrix element of C naught is the same as the matrix element of C naught dagger. That's what it means to be real, and that's what it means to be a Majorana. Now, then you can show that this kinetic energy that we are talking about preserves this to all orders. Okay? And if they are Majoranas, they can be represented by Ising spins. And this is really the physics behind this Affleck, Ludwig, Maldacena, Ludwig reduction of the problem, which was an SO8 problem to begin with. It becomes an SO7 cross an Ising problem. This is it. And therefore, I was very amused when one of your colleagues a few weeks ago was talking about problems which are of the SO7 cross Ising variety. He referred to some kind of spin liquids in conformal field theory by something called stifle liquids. And well, here is a explicit example where you can take a microscopic model and go into SO7 cross IC. Okay, so the answers that you get from this approach are identical to what the Wilson RG exact numerical solution of this Affleck Ludwig, etc. Now, what was remarkable about this two-side problem is that Clemas Seed and Krishnamurti and I discovered that we can do a mean field theory after we have bosonized and fermionized the problem of the two impurities. We can do a mean field theory, keeping all the symmetries of the problem, and then do mean field theory. And the reason I'm invoking this is that this pair problem that I just did in the bath of fluctuations, it's okay for the two impurities, but if I extend it to the lattice, it's not very helpful. However, if I can do my mean field, the two-side problem, and get the same answers as in the exact solution, for some mysterious reason, which I think I understand, I can extend it approximately to the lattice problem. Okay? Now, the way the mean field theory would be done would be to have this object again fermionized for the pair. Okay, so now if I'm doing lattice, I'm going to make approximation of solving a dimer at a time, okay, and self-consistent. Then I have the same problem that I wrote down earlier, but with the label mu per dimer site. And this problem had four parameters. The two-side problem, the way I was able to diagonalize, had four parameters. One, ordinary kinetic energy, and this is what I meant by axial charge. Axial charge in this case means that H is equal to M, the pairing part. This will begin to look a little familiar. this is what Katya wrote down at the beginning of a problem, so to speak. Here I can derive it in the two-side problem coupling to the others. And then you are coupling with the C fermion to the neighbor. So when I'm doing the lattice fermion, I'm going to assume that there is this object C, which is some kind of fermion operator, show that in the mean field theory, the C is a Majorana. This I can only show when M equal to H and for some particular ratio of J1 over J2. It turns out that when J1 equal to J2, M is automatically H in the self-consistent mean field theory. Then C is a Majorana. If C is a Majorana, I can, from the linear combination, what C and C dagger coupled to in terms of the D operators, identify a linear combination of D, which is a Majorana, and its conjugate Majorana. And so then I have a self-consistent theory in terms of propagating Majoranas in which I have to determine these parameters self-consistent. Okay? So that is what is done. So that's the mean field ansatz for the lattice. We write down the problem in terms of Majoranas, assume that the interdimer interaction is only through Majoranas, and determine these Majoranas in terms of these D operators. Okay? Now, this is a simple quadratic problem now, except that we started with a dimer basis, so it's not a periodic arrangement. So to do this problem, one would have to solve a fermion problem on a random lattice with the topology of where the dimers can sit. But I can calculate for the moment local properties, local frequency dependent Green's function and correlation with an assumption that they say it's one-dimensional fermions coupling to each dimer, so that the Majoranas have a constant density of states. So when I do that, I can calculate these local even and odd parity Green's function. And what I discover is that all these objects have a simple pole at omega equal to zero, and a continuum. And if you have a simple pole and a continuum, you can show that the fluctuation spectra is of this form for, okay? And all the properties that I assumed earlier follow. C over T proportional to lambda over T follows. But I've assumed a dimer basis, and I don't know much about dimers. I've just taken an arrangement, okay? There's a prediction that the staggered susceptibility has a log T divergence if I'm exactly at criticality. If I'm not exactly at criticality, if M is not exactly H, this log is cut off at low temperatures. It'll be a constant rather than a log. Okay. Let me make a connection. You have seen properties of the, you know, Kitaev had this, you know, either take the toric code or the Kitaev model. Kitaev cleverly invented this model and got the ground state and excitation spectra, but to calculate the thermodynamics, people did Monte Carlo calculations, very lovely Monte Carlo calculations by Nasu, Udagawa, Motone. And what we discover is that if you take some extreme range of parameters in the toric code, meaning take one of those objects have very low energy, you know, you have the stars and the plackets, have one of them have very, very low energy, and the other is, and those are the localized fluxons or whatever you want to call them, and then you have a continuum of excitation. Now, if you calculate the fluctuation spectra in between their temperature range, it's roughly a constant, okay? This can be moved down as you move the toric cold, one of the parameters down. And if you move it way down, then you get specific heat going as linearly in temperature as Nasu Udagawa Motone found. Now, actually, you don't have to do these calculations. What you see is something. You see, I've dealt with this constant in omega, more or less momentum independent fluctuations somewhat earlier in my life when I proposed the marginal Fermi liquid. And I discovered then that it's very easy to get them. It's very hard to justify that, justify what you get, but it's very easy to get them. So this is already stated in 1991. You know that if you have degenerate fermions, okay, and you do one loop calculation of the fluctuation spectra, you get omega over QVF, right? And if you put in all kinds of vertices, you get Landau theory, omega over some energy scale. That's the Fermi liquid. If you take this objects to be classical objects, so that you have Curie susceptibility, what is the object, what's the absorptive spectrum of a system which gives you Curie susceptibility? It is of the form 1 over t omega over t with a cutoff e to the minus omega over t. This you will get by doing a one loop calculation with classical objects. However, if you have a classical object, meaning something at very low energy compared to the temperature you're dealing with, and something which have a Fermi energy so that density of states can be defined. And this Fermi energy scale is larger than the temperature that you're dealing with. So if your temperature is smaller than the Fermi energy, but much larger than this classical object, or whatever object that is, it is classical if the temperature is larger than its characteristic scale. Now, if you do one loop calculation, you get out your tangent hyperbolic omega. Okay. So all this toric code giving to Udagawa, Matane, etc., is a realization of that. And that's precisely what I'm talking about here, because I got a pole in these objects, and then I have a continuum with a higher energy scale. And if you calculate that, you get this omega over t, okay? Okay, so I am more or less done. There are several things which I do not understand about the starting point. First of all, this dimer basis on which I did self-consistency, it's like doing dynamical mean field theory with a dimer, starting with an effective Hamiltonian, which is not the bare Hamiltonian, but first bosonizing and fermionizing the surrounding media, and then doing the dynamical mean field theory in terms of that around the dimer, and then showing that whatever excitations that you assume, that there are some kinds of fermions or Majoranas around, that is self-consistently reproduced by the dimer solution, okay? That's the approach. And of course, this can be systematically extended by considering a pair of dimers nearby in all orientations and so on. So it can be seen whether this is a convergent approximation or not. Now, this thing has given me the right kind of number, because I started with the right kind of number for the arrangement of entropy to arrangement of dimers to give me the entropy, what I call the dark entropy. I do not understand it. I especially do not understand why it's so impervious to magnetic field. It is that you can see that the state that I have generated, in which every dimer is interacting with the fluctuations of the rest of the media, that arrangement cannot be easily disturbed Therefore, the holes in the triangular lattice where the dimers are not occupied cannot easily be disturbed as well. That's my current way of thinking about it, but I do not fully understand it. I do not know what deviations from the perfect Heisenberg interactions on a perfect triangular lattice is important for the problem that I'm talking about. So, on a triangular lattice, at least, if not on a Kagome lattice, I could have taken an ordered arrangement of dimers and done the same thing. Now, if you have an ordered arrangement of dimers, you can very easily see that you can locally make flips among the configuration of the dimers. You don't have to make non-local flips. You can make locally local flips, and that entropy would disappear. Now, I gave you an example of a triangular lattice in which you get same kinds of entropy, but same kind of C over T and the muon relaxation rate, but which did not have any dark entropy, okay? So my guess, is, you know, it's only a guess, is that that is the difference, what arrangement you have, and what arrangement you have is probably determined by the deviations from perfect Heisenberg interactions on a perfect lattice on any given compound. I also needed to do tuning of parameters to get the properties that I had to get the experiment. I do not fully understand how to relate those tuning of parameters to microscopic parameters. And I have not yet even begun to think about the role of the impurities. This other compound that I talked about, LCZSO, also has dark entropy, but it has this 3% extra Schottky impurities. It has also some magnetic impurities. And then the low energy entropy, or the missing entropy, is only half of the purest compound that I talked about. And I do not understand that. Looking through the data in the literature, I have a feeling that if more compounds are made which are, by good luck, serendipity, and chemical techniques, purer, there'll be more such things that will be discovered. I look forward to your questions. That's the end of my talk. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Chandra. Maybe I could just start with the question. I might have missed something. So you mentioned explicitly that you're not locally enlarging the Hilbert space, right?
Could you please speak a little slower?
Yeah, sure. So in one slide, you mentioned that you're not enlarging the Hilbert space locally.
Yes.
You're avoiding that.
Yes.
But then somehow there's still these emergent Majoranas in your at the end.
So I have an ordinary fermion should really be represented by a pair of Majoranas,
mm-hmm.
and not four like many people do. Okay, it's possible to represent an ordinary fermion just by two Majoranas.
Right. So is this still some Z2 gauge theory at the end of the day, or no? Like,
it may be related. Okay. I mean, it may be related in the sense that Z2 gauge theory and toric code if you think they are related, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about Z2 gauge theory, again, you have to go to some large n limit, right? Now, I think what you're saying is a very interesting question. What is the class of models what is the class of realistic models? Okay, I only deal with realism. What is the class of realistic models in which the excitations break up into very weakly interacting, very low energy fluctuations,
mm-hmm.
of, let us say, singlet variety in this case, or icing variety, or something very specific, and then a continuum of excitations. To the extent that there may be a wide class of models in which the end result is just this, this end result, which is really written down by hand in the toric code to begin with, the measurable properties will be similar. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. Can I maybe ask a question? I could actually explain what I had in mind after your experimental part, but I would rather ask a different question, which is, for me at least, it's more interesting, about material part of the physics. Now, in your material, standard valences would be copper 2+, antimony 5+.
Is it really? One thing
we
know, it's a very, very good insulator. And copper is copper 2+.
Understand. Very good insulator, fine. Is it really proven that it is indeed copper 2+, for example, by spectroscopy or by ESR or whatever? I explain why I'm asking that. I was recently involved in a study of one very interesting material by Satoru Nakasugi. He was the first to study it. And it's completely different structure, but strangely enough, it also contains copper and antimony. This barium 3, copper, antimony 209, containing honeycomb lattice of copper. And standard assumption was also copper 2+, antimony 5+. But it did not have any magnetic ordering at low temperatures, and moreover, it did not show any indication of Yanteller effect, which should be present in copper 2+ in octahedra. Now, and recently, Takashi Mizukawa in Tokyo, they made high energy spectroscopy, and they saw that this assumption of valences was not really correct. There is a lot of ligand holes. Simply speaking, one can say that we have something copper 2+, antimony 5+, but antimony 5+, maybe 4+ ligand hole, or maybe 3+2 ligand hole. And this ligand hole can be attached to antimony, then it's 5+, or it can be attached to copper, and then it will be copper 2+ ligand hole. That's Jean-Grice singlet. So that's a different source of singlets, not your dimers, for example, in triangular lattice. There's a lot of fluctuations. That's actually experimental fact by high energy spectroscopy. So I don't want to claim that it's indeed the case in your material, maybe not at all, but I simply think that it might be very interesting really to check if it's indeed this assignment of valences copper 2+, is copper 2+, is really copper 2+, or maybe something else is also happening here.
Okay, Daniel, I think I only very partially understood you. Would you be so kind as to send me an email with the reference?
I will think about it
and I'll write back to you. Okay.
Okay, I will send you archive paper by Mizukawa, Nakasugi, and I was also involved.
Okay.
Okay. Very good.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I had a question about the, how do these singlet excitations cause a muon spin relaxation? How does, I think of a singlet as being non-magnetic. So where does, Can you predict the size of the local field that these excitations should make at the muon?
Zero.
Then what relaxes the muon polarization in the data you showed us?
The observed excitations. The excitations with which I calculated the specific heat. I showed you they are magnetic field dependent.
Okay.
Where the specific heat appears, the muon relaxation rate is also magnetic field dependent. And everything that is observed, given the specific heat, it's magnetic field dependent, tells you that they are magnetic excitations. and the magnetic fields, and I calculate the muon relaxation rate only in terms of them. You remember? Yeah. I said that the relaxation rate time there is related to the inverse of the exchange energy, which I deduce from the specific heat and the magnetic susceptibility. So singlet, that's why I kept on calling, and I mean it more seriously than it may appear. I kept on calling the singlets as my dark entropy. Dark means that it's very hard to conceive of an experiment in which you can observe them. You see, when people say there is ground state entropy, what that means is that it is an entropy which is temperature independent. If there is temperature independent entropy, there's no way of seeing that entropy. Okay? In this case, within this range of from 0 to 9 Tesla, it is also unperturbed by magnetic field. So it's truly dark, at least up to that magnetic field. Okay? It would be very amusing to try to devise a spectroscopy experiment to see singlet excitations. And you will see that it's very hard. It's harder than seeing a Higgs boson. You know, Higgs boson is a scalar excitation. It's very hard to see it. And you will see that these objects are even harder to see that than that, because they're singlets. They are chargeless, spinless. They have nothing, and except entropy. And entropy is like mass. If they are there, we know they have to be there. But I cannot think of a spectroscopic experiment to see them. Is that a long-winded reply to your question, Greg?
Thank you. Thank you,
Chandra. Can I ask a question? So, if 9 Tesla is not enough to change the nature of these things, right? So you have very robust singlets. What are the magnetic excitations that are, you know, what's the nature of these magnetic excitations that are responsible for the relaxation and for the end?
I can say from their magnetic field dependence of their entropy that they are, I can say to some limited accuracy that they have spin one.
But this was essentially what I asked you during your talk. You are starting with singlets made of 2 copper 2+, but whereas you have singlet, there should be also triplet state of the same dimer. So what is the energy of this single triplet transition for copper to dimer? That's essentially the same question.
I told you the exchange energies, right?
That's the same 10 Kelvin.
One exchange energy is around 4 Kelvin, and another exchange energy is around 20 Kelvin. And what's very nice about this compound is that every property that has been measured up to now, and they are not too many, however, every property can be expressed in terms of that one parameter per layer, every property. Mm-hmm. And that should be a generic feature of spin liquids. Not just this class of spin liquids, but any class of spin liquids. You should be probably have only the exchange energy determining all the measured properties.
So typically about 10 Kelvin, for example, right?
Okay, then follow. Any other question? Okay, Tim, so should I say goodbye?
Yeah. I think we did several good questions. So let's.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Yeah. Thanks for the great time. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.